This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, and I cover race, identity, and culture for KCUR. Today, I'm hosting this special episode to explore a topic I call The Hidden Visible, Women of Color in the Kansas City Area.
Inclusion in leadership, I think that that's really important. Not just coming in and, again, having a nice photo op, but having a voice at the table. From the very beginning, helping to organize, helping to add perspective. I think it's a lot of times so easy to see who is at the table by seeing what the result is.
How do we build a grassroots network where we're talking about immigration, where we're talking about incarceration and access to education in such a way that in which we're not buying into the politic that keeps us engaged in marginalizing one another as women of color?
I do believe that I have met people who are very passionate about gender equity, but get so disturbed, annoyed, and vitriolic towards conversations of race and race inequity.
Let me tell you how this all began. I'm a Black woman, and recently I had dinner with two female friends who are also women of color. It was after an event where there was a panel discussion about race, yet no women of color were on the panel. Over dinner, my friends and I discussed how common this is, that women of color occupy so many spaces but are so often excluded from the conversations that matter. Who do I mean by women of color? Women who are Black, Latinx, Asian, or Native American, or other races or ethnicities that don't identify as white. Currently, women of color are 18% of the U.S. population and are projected to outnumber white women by 2062. But when people in this country talk about race, the emphasis is usually on men, yet when gender comes up, people most often are talking about white women. That dinner sparked this idea to invite eight women of color here to KCUR to share a meal together, followed by a wide-ranging conversation about their experiences in a lot of different aspects of life in Kansas City. On today's show, we're bringing you an edited version of that conversation. Let's start at the beginning. Here's who was in the room.
Celia Reese.
Diane Burkholder.
Denise Perkins.
Janet Jackson.
Paku Her.
Denisha Snell.
Christina Marie Mitchell.
Corey Carew.
Got that? I know, it's a lot of names. Don't worry about it. We'll mention some of their names again this hour. But what's more important are their stories. One of the most spirited parts of the conversation was talking about representation and intersectionality. For those not familiar with the term, intersectionality is the way in which different identities intersect within ourselves and with other people. So, generally speaking, how is navigating the world different for women of color than it is for women who are white? Like the women's marches or the Me Too movement. For example, Paku Her, who's Asian American, is a grassroots organizer and equity trainer. She didn't find the local women's march last year as inclusive as it could have been.
It was the perfect example of, yes, I'm taking my children to see this because this is a momentous occasion. All of that experience is invaluable as a moment in history and time that she should experience. And it was very obvious that it was a movement driven by well-meaning white women who, one, didn't know how to organize, and two, suddenly cared about and I'm not saying, I don't mean to poo-poo, like, clearly these are women who have experienced sexism, like, absolutely. And also who were universalizing their whiteness in that experience. And it was really fascinating because I was asked to, when Pantsuit Nation was still a thing in Kansas City, with huge following, huge. I mean, there were white women banging on doors to get into those Pantsuit Nation meetings. And I was asked to come in and lead a conversation about whiteness and race in the context of this movement. People were politely kind, but not engaged, right? And so I wasn't, like, why should I be surprised? Like, that's the reason why there's a feminist movement and a womanist movement, because feminists in the United States, white feminists, wouldn't talk about race, and that women of color have been in the workforce forever. White women are protesting so they can join the workforce and be like, women of color, like, it's about time.
So that gets back to something, I'm sure some of you, all of you maybe, have been asked this. There's always probably on average every 6 months a white woman who asks me, so Michelle, why can't we get more women of color to come to our organizations, events, rallies, whatever? Say, Denise.
inclusion. Okay, so we're going to have a diversified group of people. But what's the point of bringing in these people if you're not going to actually include them via voice, participation, if you're just going to center yourselves and we're just the decoration, we're just the background to your foreground? So that's why that's why I choose not to go.
That's Denise Perkins, a Native American education coordinator, followed up by Professor Janet Jackson, a law professor who has her own take on inclusion.
And inclusion in leadership, I think that's really important. Not just coming in and, again, having a nice photo op, but having a voice at the table. Mm-hmm. From the very beginning, helping to organize, helping to add perspective. I think it's a lot of times so easy to see who is at the table by seeing what the result is. I mean, I can almost always tell, okay, there were no people of color at that table making those decisions because this was the result. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens. So I think it's allowing people, including people in leadership positions.
Yeah. And also, you know, a focus on belonging as well with that inclusion, right? You know, one of the things that we're seeing, and I don't think it's just politics, rallies, it's in our organizations, it's in our communities, it's in our churches. It's everywhere. You know, what we see often is, I hate to say it, but there is an element of awareness of gender issues and a dismissiveness of race that leads to a pushing of conformity, right? So you're invited to come, but as long as you can be, you know, the example I give at work when we talk about conformity, it's like, hey, Corey, we like having you here as long as you can be the whitest black girl possible, right? Be like us. And if there isn't an interest in the issues that affect us and impact us, and there isn't a care about that, then why would we come? And so you hear that even in the conversation around income and equity, when we're talking about equal payday, and we're only talking about the number of what white women make, and we're not talking about the fact that black women make less and Hispanic women make even less, then how do you expect people to feel like they're part of a community and that they belong and that what they have to contribute is actually valuable? Mm-hmm. And so I actually will go so far as to say that embedded in a lot of our women's initiatives and the feminism movement is a threat of racism. Mm-hmm. I do believe that I have met people who are very passionate about gender equity, but get so disturbed, annoyed, and vitriolic towards conversations of race and race inequity. And if I hear one more time, well, but that's all women,
But all lives matter.
Yeah. But all lives matter.
Someone
right.
had to say it.
Thank you.
This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Michelle Tyreen Johnson with this special broadcast called The Hidden Visible, Women of Color in Kansas City. In a minute, we'll dig into the topics of employment and housing. I'm Michelle Tyreen Johnson. I report on race, identity, and culture here at KCUR. And this is KCUR Central Standard in a special episode called The Hidden Visible, Women of Color in Kansas City. I invited 8 women of color to KCUR to break bread and have a conversation with the tape running on that intersection of gender and race in our society. With so many examples recently of police being called on people of color for grilling in a park, napping in a college dorm, or playing in their own yard, our guests share how these types of interactions affect them right here in Kansas City. Here's Corey Carew, who is a Black inclusion and belonging strategist.
It's as if we're constantly being asked to apologize for who we are, right? So if we are passionate, we're angry. If we stand firm, we're aggressive. If we put boundaries and don't take you're aggressive, right? And intimidating, which is why that video of the girl who was napping and the person who called on her, I think it resonates with so many people, because whether it's law enforcement or the day-to-day interactions in the office, there's this knowledge that if there's a disagreement or a conflict between a woman of color, and especially a black woman, and someone else who's majority, the presumption doesn't go with you, right?
They're microaggressions, all of these microaggressions. Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's like the slow drip, the slow drip, the slow drip, the slow drip. And one day it's like, wait, that's enough.
Yeah.
Stop. Right.
Christina Marie Mitchell is Black. She works in retail management.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's what made me think of this situation, because when we're talking about coming to the table, you know, all women, but you get that whole pushback of, well, not all white women, not all, you know, that is the conversation that's what keeps me from going to, you know, all of these different rallies and marches, because I know at some point I'm like, let's give it time. It's going to happen. Somebody's going to say it.
Yeah.
And so all of those microaggressions, you know, tend to rear their ugly head at some point, to the point where, you know, women of color don't feel comfortable coming into these spaces because we're tired.
Yeah.
We're just tired.
So then
well,
I think we're not being fed.
We're not being fed. We're serving. For so much of the feminist movement, we have served. We've partnered. We've been part of the fight.
Yeah.
And yet still our issues are not being heard. Our children are not being talked about. Our grief is not being, you know, the tears are not shared. And I think that's part of why we have womanism, and that's part of why people are beginning to create different circles where they can focus their energies differently. And we can call it identity politics or whatever you want to call it. And we can say it's fragmenting the movement, but the truth is, if you're not feeding the body, people are going to find other ways to enrich themselves, and we're finding other ways to do that.
Celia Calderon Ruiz is Latinx. She owns a small t-shirt business with her wife.
So going back to that intersectionality piece, so we talked about a couple different topics, but so many of these mean zero in my daily life. Because right now with this administration, it's immigration. It's documented and undocumented and documented. Earlier this week or last week, hearing about a Spanish-speaking couple of friends being detained up in Montana, North Dakota, somewhere out towards that area. I mean, that's what I'm thinking about every single day. My intersectionality is immigration, politics, and administration that's connected to the immigration piece. You know, LGBTQ, I travel out through rural Kansas, and I would never, ever say my wife. I have to keep censoring myself every single day and every single presentation saying, ho, 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 my husband, because I'm in the middle of a place where I am alone and not protected by anything else. So coming back to the Me Too, I don't got time for Me Too. Like, I got way other stuff to be worried about, you know, than to think about all these other more analytical pieces to, you know, what is intersectionality?
Yeah.
My intersectionality is like freaking like waking up.
Well, and this is so fascinating, because I think the conversation about intersectionality is easy to frame when we say we as women of color, a collective group held next to white women, having a conversation about race and gender equity presents all these challenges. And I think what you just shared is that, like, we have all kinds of challenges that we don't address, like anti-blackness in the Asian American community, or like extreme nationalism in communities of color where people of color want to build a goddamn wall. Like, all of these dynamics where, like, people don't even know what's happening in indigenous communities or what's going on with water protectors because nobody cares. And so we are concerned about whether or not we are achieving parity with white women. And we don't know anything about what's happening amongst our own communities. And so, like, if we dig more deeply at a conversation about intersectionality, I think that's what we see, right? Like, I don't control what white people will or will not do, or will or won't learn. Like, I don't have energy to wait for that. But I think the challenge as women of color, right? Like, as an organizer, I'm always like, how do we build power? How do we build power to produce a different outcome? How do we build a grassroots network where we're talking about immigration, where we're talking about incarceration and access to education in such a way that in which we're not buying into the politic that keeps us engaged in marginalizing one another as women of color.
And I think the beauty of intersectionality, if we look at it well, is to find the places where we can leverage and support each other, right? So, like you, partially, my intersectionality of what I'm always thinking about and what I've been thinking about since November 16th is, I'm an immigrant. I'm also in an interracial marriage, so my children are biracial. Though the world will see them, and as far as the world's concerned, they're Black. But they've got to navigate that and figure that out. Half of my family is Muslim, okay? My grandfather converted to Christianity, so my great-grandfather was an imam. And so you go through all these things, that these circles that overlap, and if we do intersectionality right, we have a better sense of being empathetic towards each other, even if we don't have exactly the same journey. But that, what I desire, is that that intersectionality will make me look at a Palestinian woman, or look at a Native American woman, you know, somebody from the first peoples of this country, and they're struggling, go, wow, I'm not that, but I kind of know what that feels like, and how can we support each other? I think that's the goal.
Yeah.
And even with white women, that should be the goal. And whoever wants to get on the bus gets on the bus, and whoever doesn't want to get on the bus, we're going.
We're trying to survive, right?
Denisha Snell is Black and is a community engagement consultant and podcaster.
You're trying to survive in your way. I'm trying to survive in my way. I may not always see what you're seeing, but we have the same struggle because we are trying to survive. And I think if we understood that, even you may not look at the outside of me and say she's struggling, but there's a struggle going on, right? And so I think for us to understand each other on the basic level is that there's a struggle, and I'm hustling trying to make it. You're hustling trying to make it.
Speaking of hustling, another topic the women of color in our discussion explored is employment. An example of how employment plays out differently is in earnings, where women of all racial and ethnic groups get paid less than the men in the same groups, and all the women, on average, make less than white men.
I can only speak mostly from the nonprofit sector, because that has been most of my experience and grassroots work here in town. I think this is indicative of how the lay of the land happens across the country, but it's mostly dominated by white women, and white men the further you go up in administration. Those that are doing direct services or volunteer are usually the folks that look most like the community. I think the higher up an organization goes, the more money they have, the more corporate they feel. We see this discrepancy more and more, and those are the folks that are usually getting the funding, getting the accolades, getting the press, getting the big fundraisers, and those that are doing the grassroots work that look like the community are scrapping for everything else.
I've done government work, local government. I have done nonprofit work. Those boots on the ground, those who are in the community, are normally those that are at the lowest rungs of the organizations. The higher up you get, the less it looks like those of us sitting around here. Black women represented more so than Latinx women, you know. So definitely what Diane said rings true. And it's very, I think it looks like that around the country, but I think Kansas City's a little different. I think we're further behind than a lot of other cities, but it's been exactly the same thing. Lowest rung, people, boots on the ground, it's folks of color, the higher up you go, less so.
Yeah. Do you guys, anybody think that the board, you know, this city is really, has a lot of boards, has a lot of people with money, has a lot of folks with foundations and,
There are women of color in leadership in high circles who are hoarding their power and space. So, like, especially if we're talking about philanthropy, and we're talking about where money sits and how grassroots communities do or don't get funded, where respectability is the rule, acceptability is the rule, and ain't nobody crying about making six figures in that place. And so, like, you know, it is funny in the same way that, like, we can talk about even the kinds of women of color who have come into this room as a unit, which we aren't. There's this sense that, like, well, women of color, of course, would be invested in other women of color's betterment. That's not true. We can see that anywhere. Just in the same way that women can internalize patriarchy,
I know a lot
women of color can internalize white supremacy too.
I know a lot of women of color. They not only did not get they're not in this room because they didn't get invitations.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so I think that is real. And there are moments when I think several of us in this room have said, "Could we organize them? Or could we organize them?" Some of us have tried. Sadly, it's not. In some instances, it's not worked. In other instances, the trajectory of change is long, but maybe possible. And then there are some folks who I think really are changing, and some people who are seeing themselves in relationship to women of color and communities of color differently, given their power, and recognizing that even in that place, their power is still positional, conditional, based on their race and gender identity. And so, like, I'll be the first to say that it's not as if all women of color are going to be equally invested in one another. And it's fascinating in this town too, across political spectrums, that like one of the things I've also observed is like what happens when women of color enter spaces together and compete for resources and time and visibility and like all of what happens, you know, like I'm an organizer working in spaces with professional organizers and consultants. And in this town, that number of folks is increasing. And it's creating all kinds of mess, too.
But, you know, it's based on this myth that there's not enough for everybody.
Absolutely.
And that really is a myth, that yep. I've got mine, and if I give you any, then somehow it diminishes what I have.
Absolutely.
When in truth, it enhances what I have.
Yeah.
You know, that's so frustrating
yep.
to me.
Which is both about money and social capital and yeah. visibility.
I do think that there is a scarcity mindset that Janet talked about. There's a scarcity mindset, but there's also this layer of white supremacy that does infect organizations, mm-hmm. right? And so what happens, and it also happens with women, just women, you know, forget the subset of women of color, where the structure has been created for the benefit of some. And there's only so much diversity that it will tolerate before people start getting uneasy. Mm-hmm. And you're hypersensitive and aware that there's room for only so much. Now, theoretically, it shouldn't be that way, right? But because people get uncomfortable with too much diversity, the end result is that people sometimes feel like they have to compete with one another. Another byproduct of us sometimes not helping each other is because people don't always feel like they have the security and the protection themselves. Mm-hmm. So for example, in law firms, you know, women may not be making as much money as the male partners. There may not be as many women in the most highly compensated. So oftentimes you're looking at the one woman or the two women or the few people who do have that political, social, economic capital to pull everybody else up, and they may or may not be able to do it. We also know from studies and implicit bias that when women and minorities advocate for others who are underrepresented, they're penalized for it. Mm-hmm. And so there is a practical consequence to people's careers that they take into consideration. And I don't think you can get around that except by doing exactly what Janet said, being intentional and saying there's enough for everyone, this is my lane, this is my gift, this is my work, and it's okay. Mm-hmm. That you also have your space, and you also have a contribution. But I do think that there are the natural end result of having a system like that was not designed to let us in, is that those things happen. I can tell you that some of the most painful things that have happened to me in my career have been from people who look like me, mm-hmm. who have been threatened, unhappy by my progress. Now, yeah. that has also happened from people in the majority, where we're liberal and we're progressive and we're okay with diversity until I perceive that you have more than me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then it's a problem.
Yep.
And I know you mentioned the 80s, but I mean, it wasn't too long ago someone said, you know, who kept making comments about diversity said to me, well, you have a really good chance at this business development because you're black and you're a woman. And I finally said, actually, it's because I'm pretty good at what I do.
Right.
I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson. I report on race, identity, and culture here at KCUR. And this is KCUR Central Standard in a special episode called The Hidden Visible Women of Color in Kansas City. I invited 8 women of color to KCUR to break bread and have a conversation with the tape running on that intersection of gender and race in our society.
Those of you who have comments about private or government? Or
academic. In higher education, you see the same thing. There's a disproportionate number of people of color who are not tenured. So, and this is a discussion that we have in the academic community all the time, that you may get in, but you don't necessarily have the support system. A lot of people don't have the support system. And so we're not seeing people rise to tenure in the numbers that they really should.
Yeah, I read an article about that recently, something about that one of the reasons is because people of color who work for academia, everybody's trying to put them on a diversity board. Mm-hmm. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm the chair of my diversity board. but no, I think that is true. And one of the things that I see is that there are so few of you, especially if you're tenured, then everybody wants you to be on this panel or speak to this group. And so you're doing a lot of things, but you still have your commitment of teaching, mm-hmm. of scholarship, and everything else that you're supposed to do. Yes. And it's difficult.
And you're required to do everybody else's emotional labor while you're at it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So business, in this country they say that women of color own 1 out of every 3 businesses.
All right, so we just started a small business, my partner, well, my wife and I, and it's a t-shirt company. And so then in Spanish here it says, Hecho en Casey, made in Casey. The idea is that there is plenty of Casey Pride English language. There is not enough or any in Spanish language. And so then we have a mix of Spanish language Casey Pride and then Mexican Spanish slang. So that's what we're trying to get started right now.
So do you and anybody else who wants to jump in feel that women of color have access to the same resources in terms of starting businesses in Kansas City?
No.
No.
No. So I'm going to think, so when we were starting this off, we just had a blank idea of saying, all right, let's, put your humor and my graphic design together and we'll create this. All right, so now what do we do? All right, so let's call some business empowerment or startup, resources. And I contacted one agency. They never called me back. I called another, and they're all local KC, either Hispanic-focused or regular Kansas Cityan-focused. I got a hold of 3 different ones, never got an answer back, very vague answers, kind of expecting me to do things on my own. But I thought, you're receiving money to provide these services. And so then not getting the full support there, had to end up paying an accountant, which has not yet completed the work. And so then we're still kind of stuck in there a little bit. And I thought, you know what? We're probably the target demographic for so many people. Lesbian, Hispanic, Latino, Spanish-speaking, Kansas City, here, there. All right, we got something creative and something original. And then at least in that beginning stage, it just felt like, oh, you're just another person. And I'm like, you know what? I think we're providing something different. Not huge, but just a little hello or something.
Well, and I think with business, it's very difficult to talk about women of color owning businesses, starting businesses, and not take into account the full context of how that compares to the access that whiteness also gives people that women of color don't have access to, which is oftentimes multi-generational wealth, a lake of wealth that has been gathered, networks that are broad and vast. I'll be really honest, I have been able to build my consulting firm over the last 10 years because I knew the right white people who would leverage their power to give me access. If I had a network of only people of color, I would not have a thriving consulting business. And that's just real. And that was a clear strategy on my part, and I was really transparent. And I said, y'all know all these people at these big national digital organizations, you're gonna help me, and here's how you're gonna help me. Because I was like, I'm gonna run this like a white man does. like make a network and make it work. But I think that's the dynamic. But that's also because I had coaching. I had coaching from a woman of color who said, this is how you have to do it. And so I think it puts me at a real advantage on top of the fact that I do not identify as a Black woman. I am not an Indigenous woman. I am not from a particular racial demographic that makes life even harder. Doesn't mean that there isn't poverty among Asian Americans, but I recognize it in the race construct. I'm in a different place. So all of those things being relative, sure, I can leverage those things, but I have to do it strategically. And I think for people of color, we're constantly, women of color in particular, constantly doing the math on like, well, if I had somebody in my family who was able to acquire land or a house and then give that to me when they died, then I'd have all these resources like all these white people I see. And I'm, you know, of course I'm not saying all white people are wealthy, but you understand clearly, and the data shows that there's enough of an arc that says that that is true, that a lake and a river of wealth exists for other people that does not exist for many communities of color.
I mean, and that's real.
And you know, one thing you mentioned that, you know, you had the coaching. So that makes me think about like culturally, and this is where I've struggled. I was brought up to be the nurturer, you know, to be, you know, that we're taught that sacrificing is, mm-hmm. you know, one of your greatest qualities. And so then I am not a business person. You know, I've had people not return phone calls, not return emails. And then my partner, she says, well, come on, you're supposed to get in there and, you know, be aggressive and be assertive. I'm like, no, like I just wanted to design something. But so I think like for us culturally, I'll speak of me and maybe other business owners that I know too. I identify as Mexican. We're taught to be nurturers and selfless. And we were even taught when we were younger, you know, having money is being disconnected from your poor community. So don't try to be that rich person. And don't, you know, if the t-shirts cost us a certain dollar amount, in my mind, I'm saying, well, I think this person can pay me like a dollar more than what, and I'll still be okay. Mm-hmm. And so then I think that for us, I'll speak of me and others, that's the challenge too, is that how do you get that go-getter spirit that maybe someone else and through other generations, they were given that. Maybe they, if they did not have the full wealth of other white communities, there was a go-getter spirit, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't think we had that. You know, ours is conform and be okay with it.
Yeah. And accept less than what you're worth.
As I grew up middle, upper class, when my parents bought their first home, they could not buy east, west of Troost. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so although they could afford a home west of Troost because they both worked. So due to redlining and restrictive covenants, et cetera, they could not purchase where they could afford, so they ended up purchasing east of Troost. Now, when my parents aged, decided they wanted to leave the inner city, they sold their home. Now, imagine had they sold the home off of Ward Parkway and the money that they would have had versus selling the home east of Troost and what they got for that. I think that's the first thing that we have to remember. There are a lot of us, our parents owned homes, but because where they were forced to live, it doesn't give that return on the investment like others. The second thing was the coaching. I had a white guy who was a business owner from the middle of Kansas. We became friends. We talked a lot about, he owned farmland, he owned businesses. Denisha, just go to the SBA and get a, go to the SBA. And so I'm like, okay, he's like, you're a minority, you're a woman, you're Black, you're go to the SBA. And the SBA, you show up there and it's like, you have to have $60,000 in order to get XYZ. And so I think there's like a catch 22 with that. Supposedly we are the demographic that can get all of this. And he's saying, go get it because as a white man, I can't. But he doesn't understand that I have to have a certain amount and I can't just walk into a bank and say, I need a loan for this, hook me up, because it just doesn't work like that. And so I think that's huge that we understand that when we're trying to start a business, the institutions or the systems that are set up that are supposedly for us really were not set up for us at all.
Thank you. And you know, you brought up something that was actually my next topic, housing in the city. Do you think as a woman of color, you feel like you could go move into any neighborhood you want to?
Well, I'm not from Kansas City, so okay. This is still kind of a new thing for me. The first thing that I noticed, I moved here in 2006, was how segregated it still was. I mean, I was kind of, you know, disturbing. However, there was some good people here, but I've since learned things. I attended that presentation at the library about eviction and the eviction rates, and how just one little setback and you're out of the home and it's on your record forever. But it was pointed out, it's like, well, you know, these landlords who are bad landlords, where's their record report if they're, you know, overcharging or not keeping up with maintenance. So I feel that there are definitely barriers to people having the access to live where. Do I feel like I can move anywhere? Yes and no. But I'm kind of in a strange pocket of, you know, being a woman of color. I'm a Native American woman, so that's still kind of received sort of strange. Like, they're not sure what I am. So they kind of might want to accept me, but maybe not. So I guess the short answer would be possibly, but I haven't lived here long enough to really feel if, okay, let me move over here, and am I getting some, you know, strange looks of
it. Is it going to hit when it hits? It will hit. I say it will, I don't want it to, but, you know, will it get towards my mother-in-law's house? Will it get towards, you know, other family members' houses? You know, they've already purchased their homes. You know, who else do I know that? Those businesses. Oh, I know that business owner. And so then now for me to start see it creep up on the northeast side, I'm like, crap, it's going to unfortunately get closer. And now it becomes more real that I've seen what has happened to the west side specifically. You know, we went out not too long ago. We had some family members come in, and there's like this big open lot area where you can kind of see the 35 area. And so we're like, all right, kids, you know, let's go play soccer. Like, you know, go look at the city off of here. And the family that came in from out of town, they're like, whoa, these houses are huge. And you said this is the Mexican neighborhood? We're like, yeah, not really, but that's what it used to be. And so then it feels sad to see how straightforward it is on that side, and then to think, again, crap, is it going to happen over here that bad?
I think that what seems most disturbing is that it doesn't seem that there's any effort when people move in to kind of integrate within the community to find out what the concerns are of people that are in the community, and so. People who have lived there for years and for generations, a lot of times can't afford to stay, are pushed out, and there's no conversation about that. That just seems to be okay.
I don't know that the experience of living in the suburbs as a black woman is all too different than working in corporate America or going to a white school. I think there's constantly that question or awareness that at any moment your belonging may be questioned and your presence may be questioned. And I kind of feel like the tact I have taken personally throughout my time here in the United States has been, I'm going where I'm going. But there's always that awareness. Even when you go to the pool in the summer and there's nobody else that looks like you, or they're very few, and it's very noted. You know, you see other families and you're like, there's a black family down the road, and you note all the other people of color.
You're listening to a special episode of KCUR Central Standard called The Hidden Visible: Women of Color in Kansas City. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, and in a minute we'll ask our group about the barriers they face. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, here with a special program called The Hidden Visible, exploring the issues of women of color in Kansas City. Our final topic in this candid discussion is about barriers and how women of color spot them and work through them. We return to Diane Burkholder, who is black, mixed race, and queer, and a community organizer and trainer, talking about widening the discussion.
In my experience here, being a mixed race black person who's not from here, right, so I'm always going to be the outsider and queer, so I don't fit in, and I'm not religious, I'm atheist, right, so I don't fit in the boxes. And I'm a middle generation, right, I'm 37, and people think that I'm the young person to speak on a panel. I'm like, you know, I could be someone's mama. So for me, the kind of the conversations when how do we have conversations beyond the black-white binary? Being involved in spaces that are for women of color, it's been predominantly mostly black women, and then like tokens of other women. And yes, there is anti-blackness in other communities, but there's also other communities that need to be represented. And that's conversation I've had in the black community that's gotten a lot of pushback. And so black women tokenizing other women. And I think what happens too is having
that's our internalized oppression, right? That we can support one another without pushing somebody down. And I think particularly when related to the gender piece, being an organizer here in Kansas City, the barrier is most of the women, most of the femme folk are the folks that are doing all the frontline work, and the men come and go, pop in, or there may be, you know, they'll get the publicity and they'll be out, but the folks that are committed are mostly women. And I also want to like name, and I encourage us to like, continue to do the same, but we don't have any transgender women here, right? Like we are not having, not that folks weren't invited, but like we are leaving out a whole spectrum of folk, the most marginalized folk. And so we can't speak on behalf of the trans women, but like women is, we are all encompassing. And I just, as that conversation's happening, I think it's broadening a little bit more, but the transphobia that happens within our cisgender women, that's a whole other conversation when we further getting silenced or marginalized.
Well, piggybacking off of what Diane said is feeling like I'm the only one. I'm the only Native for miles around. I mean, if you could name other Natives, please let me know, because I don't happen to know any. However, it's not necessarily that I feel so alone, because I do feel very close to my other sisters that are present. But culturally, there are differences. There's a cultural language that I speak that none of you would probably recognize, except for maybe Celia, because, you know, basically she's our Southern cousin. So like when she said the nurturing, taking care, you know, that's, I was like, girl, I hear you. That's been pushed down on me most of my life. But there's subtle things that we do culturally that would be seen as disrespectful to the dominant culture, things as not smiling. Yes. Well, it's not necessarily not smiling. It's that when there's somebody speaking, we don't look directly at them. I have a hard time still doing that. But that's seen as a sign of respect. I'm listening to what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Because if I'm seeing, you know, eyeballing you, that's seen as a challenge. So in my culture, that's seen as a thing of disrespect. So it's just those things that, you know, we might want to keep in mind that culturally there are things that we, myself, have to deal with that, you know, I'm still constantly kind of battling, and am I in, you know, presenting myself in the right way that I can be understood. And so I'm actually going to be giving a workshop at the leadership conference next month, and it'll be tackling these very ideas of dismantling systems and hierarchies of organizations and working more as a collective. So that's going to be something that'll be tackled.
So along those lines, and again, kind of like the last bit of advice that I was sharing with my nephew was that, so I think of challenge, like what are our challenges? And I can speak of maybe the communities or myself or what I can identify or think of. It's like, I need to create like a new standard. Because if people are expecting me to act a certain way because I have a certain age, or because I look a certain age, or because I am a certain height, or because, again, the workplace and professionalism, and or mixing up the Spanish or the English, or this more the culture or less of this culture, I'm like, that's way too much pressure. And we're thinking about all of these other, you know, topics that we talked about. I was like, hold on, I'm not like anyone else. And like this little picture that I'm going to create of myself, you're going to have to accept it. And so I think that my challenge or challenge of, I'll say, like younger people being grown up, you know, being raised here biculturally or bilingually, and having to balance all of these worlds and how much should I do and more or less, I think the challenge for us is creating a standard that I'm going to make other people respect and recognize. So maybe I don't fit your box, and maybe it's too much or it's too little here, but I don't got time for that. I really, really don't. Like, this is what I figured out for myself, and it's my challenge to figure out how much is too much or too little, but I am tired. So I think our responsibility, and I told him, your responsibility is to create another standard for this young Mexican boy that's going to teach his little sisters what it's like to dream and do something big, but then still be grounded and go back and visit your grandparents and, you know, raise them with Spanish and pay attention to the news and do all of this. You can. So my challenge is creating my standard.
Anybody else for relief?
I think the challenge that I've been observing in Kansas City around women, for women of color, has to do with this emerging sense of, and I think I work in like sort of progressive circles, is this sense that there is some way to determine racial political purity, that some of us have better strategies than others, or some of us know more, or this approach is better. And I've been really troubled by how that emerges in lots of ways. In one way, in political spaces where we could make impact, it shows up in folks deciding that like strategy is the same as respectability politics, which it isn't. Strategy is strategy to achieve an outcome. And I have observed in lots of circles more and more this like sense of ripping apart. I think it's partly the nature of the political landscape we live in now, where there's a sense of urgency, people's survival. How are we going to make a real difference in people's everyday lives and make systemic change at the same time? And I have seen that rather than seeing people come together, people of color and women of color come together and really hash out a big strategy, I see people fighting about whose approach is best. Mm-hmm. And it's troubling to me, because I think that's actually how movements break. Mm-hmm. And that's been hard to see. And I've also observed this thing too. I think this is probably because of like the toxic political environment we live in, where many of us feel hopeless, is that we spend a lot of time like weaponizing our suffering with one another, mm-hmm. and acting that out and talking shit about each other or whatever it is. And it has been really disturbing to me to observe that. I recognize too that like part of my strategy has been like, I'm just gonna withdraw. But by withdrawing, it means I'm farther away from a community where there could be change. And I think that those are real dynamics in this political climate that I didn't see quite the same way a year ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And either we could choose to engage it, or you know, some of us will probably, for our own mental health, choose not to engage it right now because there's other strategy to attend to. But I am disturbed by it. And I think it's not going to be white people who will be our undoing. It'll be our own engagement and what we will or won't do that will be our undoing.
Our time is up for today's special. This conversation wasn't remotely representational in terms of the diversity of women among women of color. There are so many more in-depth questions and topics we could have covered, but the women of color in this discussion covered a lot of ground. So special thanks to our guests who joined us here in KCUR Studios: Celia Calderon Ruiz, Diane Burkholder, Denise Perkins, Professor Janet Jackson, Paku Herr, Denisha Snell, Christina Marie Mitchell, and Corey Carew. If you didn't catch the whole show or want to share it, find the audio later today at kcur.org/Central Standard. Today's special episode of Central Standard was produced with the help of Latina Suzanne Hogan, as well as three white dudes, a black guy, a white lady, and a Ukrainian: Chris Young, Ron Jones, Anna Yakutinko, Mike Russo, Cody Newell, and Brianna O'Higgins. Our senior producer is the brilliant Brazilian Sylvia Maria Gross. Special thanks to Sharing America, a public radio collaborative funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, including Kansas City, St. Louis, Hartford, and Portland, Oregon. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson.